you. Chipman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Dave Chipman. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Maria Tarazias. This is a case where my client, Ms. Tarazias, had a child born to her, Santiago, born in 2012, April 2012. When the child was approximately 3 years of age, he was taken into the custody of DHHS and placed in foster care. The time that he was placed into the custody of DHHS, the Stevens, who are the appellees in this case, were the foster parents. In June of 2015, my client signed a voluntary relinquishment, and the same day also signed a communication agreement, which allowed her basically to receive somewhat regular updates from the Stevens and also a yearly visit. Then in May of 2016, the adoption decree was approved for Santiago, the child. And at that hearing, the communication agreement was not approved by the juvenile court. Shortly prior to that hearing, my client had a visit with the child, saw the child. And then in May, the court didn't approve the actual agreement. Then in May of 2017, my client, unaware, you know, at the time that the agreement had not been approved by the court, then subsequently found out in April of 2017, when she tried to have a visit with the child, we filed a petition for habeas corpus. The Stevens responded by filing a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. They did not file an answer. They filed a 12B6 motion. A hearing was held in July of 2017 regarding that motion to dismiss. At the hearing itself, the Stevens offered three exhibits. One exhibit is somewhat inconsequential. It was actually attached to the petition for habeas corpus, which was a communication agreement executed by the parties back in June of 2015. The other one was a transcript of the adoption proceeding, and then the final one was the voluntary relinquishment of my client.
You said your client was unaware. What is the record? Tell us about that.
There is no record on that, simply because this was a 12B6 motion. So, we had filed a habeas corpus action. We had pled specifically in our petition that her voluntary appearance, or her voluntary relinquishment, and her consent to adoption were done through coercion and duress and fraud. We felt that basically we just had to give the basic pleadings statements to have a recognizable claim. So there's case law that clearly states that you have to plead fraud, coercion, or duress within 2 years of the adoption taking place to have a recognizable claim, and we did so. That's the Megan H. versus Mark J. case, and so we felt that we could stand on the complaint itself.
Doesn't fraud have to be pled with greater particularity than other factual allegations?
If it does, I'm not aware of that fact. It seemed that basically what we had to do was we had to plead the fact that there was duress, coercion, or fraud, and so any of those three seemed like they would be sufficient to state a basis to vacate the voluntary relinquishment and or consent to adoption.
If I read the fraud, duress, and coercion language as conclusions, what factual allegations are there that support the existence of fraud, duress, or coercion in the complaint? What in the complaint can you point me to that shows there was fraud, duress, or coercion?
So in paragraph 6, it talks about the fact that the respondents made false representations basically to the petition in this case regarding her ability to see the child. There was a relationship there, existing relationship with the foster parents, now adoptive parents, and the respondent. And so it talks about that they made promises and representations to her to induce her to basically enter her voluntary relinquishment and also to consent to the adoption. And it would seem under 12B6 that the proper standard here is that you look to the face of the complaint. You don't necessarily look to the substantive merits of the case. And so basically, I think that's what the case is ultimately decided on. If you look at the judge's decision in this case, she ultimately made the decision that because there was this communication agreement, that that was dispositive of my client's claims. In essence, because this agreement was taking place, then she absolutely was barred from relinquishing or from trying to vacate her relinquishment or her consent to adoption. And so that, I don't really think that can be the case, though. I mean, she pled, you know, in paragraph 4 that it was her consent was done under duress, coercion, false pretenses, and there are other factors beyond this communication agreement. So that, you know, the execution of the communication agreement cannot be necessarily dispositive of this type of a claim. It's not the only thing that my client was standing on. She should have had an opportunity to actually bring forth sufficient facts. And so if this was actually a summary judgment, it might have made more sense.
Well, what was it?
It was a 12B6. It was a motion to dismiss 12B6 hearing. And even as I objected to the offering of these exhibits, the respondent's counsel actually states in the record, I'm not offering these necessarily, you know, I'm not offering these for any other reason other than to provide the court with some basis to support our 12B6 motion.
Did the court give you an opportunity to offer any exhibits or get a continuance to offer exhibits if you wished?
The court said, do you wish more time to offer any exhibits? And I said no, because the fact was I was there for a 12B6 motion. I was never under any notice whatsoever that this was going to be a summary judgment hearing. At no point in time did the respondents or did the court say, I'm going to treat this as a summary judgment hearing and, you know, so go forth and find more evidence and offer evidence. I was standing on my complaint, which I felt like...
So this was not noticed up as a summary judgment?
No, Your Honor,
You didn't receive ahead of time identifying what exhibits were going to be tendered or their purpose?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I received absolutely no notice. I was there for a 12B6 motion. The court actually set the hearing as a 12B6, as a motion to dismiss hearing. At no point in time was I ever given any type of notice, was my client given any type of notice. This was a summary judgment hearing. And so, you know, we went forth with on that basis and felt that we were going to, you know, succeed because we had sufficiently stated a claim, you know, for fraud, duress, and coercion based on the case law, particularly Megan H.
But what is the fraud, duress, or coercion? What did the Stevens do that constituted fraud?
They basically told my client that they would be able to have a continuing relationship with the child. You know, they would work together.
And that was expressed in the agreement, correct?
The agreement is on its own in four corners, but there was discussion outside the agreement. And so it was more than just a simple communication agreement. And the thing about the communication agreement is it's approved or disapproved at a juvenile court proceeding, which my client, you know, which the natural parents are not to receive any notice of. And basically, if you do read the record, Ms. Stevens kind of flippantly says, I think that this agreement's not in the best interest of the child. And the court says, yeah, I'm familiar with the case. I'm going to go ahead and deny, or not approve that agreement. So there's no notice or any type of opportunity for my client to be heard. That's got to be some type of a due process violation under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, you know, and the Nebraska Constitution, I believe it's Article 1, Clause 3, in the sense that, you know, as you look at this as applied, you know, as this statute's applied to my client, she doesn't receive any notice. They just say approve or disapprove without any opportunity for my client to be heard on the case.
Did you plead a constitutional claim?
I did not plead a constitutional claim, Your Honor.
So you don't get to change horses up here, do you?
No, I'm not trying to, I apologize, I'm not trying to change horses. I'm just simply stating that there's a lot that goes into these type of agreements. It's multifaceted. So, you know, I think that if you have a summary judgment hearing, I could definitely raise the issue of constitutionality as applied regarding, you know, this agreement, and the court could rule on that.
By statute, the agreement or the failure to abide by the agreement can't be a basis for vacating the relinquishment, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So wouldn't it be strange for us to say that the agreement cannot be a basis, but we can say, well, they made promises outside of the agreement, and that can be a basis.
I don't think necessarily. I mean, I think that you can have a contract, and you can then state that the parties actually made agreements outside of the contract itself, and those can be brought into evidence. I mean, I think that happens. You know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, like a parole evidence, but the idea is that they in essence in part induced her into signing over her rights with the belief that she would have an ongoing relationship with her child.
That sounds like fraud, doesn't it?
It does sound like fraud, yes, Your Honor.
It doesn't sound like duress or coercion, does it?
Well, I mean, there's duress in the fact that if you're dealing with the HHS and they're telling you that you're going to go forth and have your parental rights terminated, that I think there's always duress when you're dealing with termination of parental rights. It's
That's not duress in the legal sense, is it?
I think it could be, Your Honor. I think there's a dissenting opinion that I found in a case I cite in my brief where the Judge Rose, I believe is his name, he says basically these people are in hard situations and they're either, you know, going to fight for their rights, you know, which is an uphill battle, or agreeing to have some type of ongoing communication with their child, you know, and so I think that is somewhat can present an opportunity of duress, Your Honor.
I see basically three parts in this petition or complaint for habeas corpus. And the first part is the relinquishment was obtained through coercion, false pretenses, or fraud. And if you got to plead that, I guess you got to plead that. The second part is the relinquishment is invalid because it's conditional. And you can't have a conditional relinquishment. That's what I'm reading in the face of the pleading, which is really, if this is truly a 12b-6, where we have to stay. And the only time I see this C&C agreement, as I call it, coming into play is that's alleged to be a condition to the relinquishment. Therefore, the relinquishment's no good because you can't have any conditions. And this is what the condition was. Then the third piece is these promises and representations, which I guess are separate from or distinct from the C&C agreement. So the only time I see the communication and consent or communication agreement coming into it is this makes the relinquishment conditional, so therefore it's no good. Is the agreement, does it have more to do with this than merely rendering the relinquishment somehow conditional and therefore invalid?
And so I would say that there's more to just the fact that there was this agreement to make it conditional. I provided the communication agreement attached to the petition really to give context to who the parties were. And at the end of the day is that it was conditional, you know, in part because I think that it's an invalid agreement, you know, given how it's enforced, but also because of the fact that there's outside discussions and representations by the respondents who are, you know, now, you know, wanting to become the adoptive parents to my client who is the natural mother. And so I think that in her mind she was retaining rights, and I think that Stevens were making promises to her about her, what she was going to retain, and therefore it was a conditional, you know. I know that private adoptions are treated differently than DHHS, you know, adoptions, but in this case it certainly seems like that, you know, my client should at least have an opportunity to go through the facts of what the fraud and coercion and duress were, or false pretenses were, in this case. And that's really what we're asking for. This was summarily dismissed on 12b-6.
And do you think the type of exhibits that were received converts this to a summary judgment motion? Are they really outside the record sort of exhibits?
I think that they were, in the sense that the transcript of the adoption proceeding, I think definitely it was, you know, there was no foundation for it. While it dealt with this actual matter, I believe it was something they would have had to come in and prove, present evidence as to this is a record and why the record mattered.
And why did that record matter, if it did? What difference did that make?
I mean, you'd have to ask necessarily the respondent, Your Honor, but I would say they believe the record mattered because it showed that this communication agreement was disapproved by the court. And so I believe that was what they found substantial.
But there's no pleading in the pleading that was filed for habeas corpus that the agreement was approved. So isn't the agreement just basically nothing?
The agreement is basically nothing because it was never approved by the court, but I think it still can be used in the context of demonstrating fraud, coercion, and duress, and false pretenses in this case. But I would say, you know, in the voluntary relinquishment, you know, we pled the fact that she relinquished her rights. We pled the fact that, you know, the agreement wasn't approved. But nevertheless, I don't think those matters should have came into evidence under 12b-6.
But you know? these agreements are statutorily provided and specifically talked about by the legislature as not being grounds for revocation or setting aside of a relinquishment.
Right, I understand that, Your Honor, but I also believe that there was more than on the face of this complaint than just the communication agreement. And so that's what the court found, is that we were basically hanging our hat completely on this communication agreement, which my client and I disagree with.
Are you merging your objectives here with fraud, duress, and coercion? And evidently the Stevens made a promise, according to you, that they would tender this communication agreement to the court for approval, and you thought that would happen, and whether or not that's a basis for undoing things, it nevertheless is some evidence of bad will or fraud or something else?
I would say that is a part of the prong, Your Honor. That is one of the examples of you know, a fraud in this case. I would say the other issues of fraud is the outside discussions they had about how they would cooperate, work with them, and give, you know, her more time and allow this child to, you know, my client to be a part of the child's life at some level. And so that's really what it comes down to. So this is the basis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ms. Kodick, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Kodick, and I represent Jeremy and Jamie Stevens in this matter. As the court's aware, the district court in this matter dismissed the complaint that was filed by the appellant. And there was a lot of testimony as to whether or not it, or a lot of argument just now as to whether or not it was a 12b-6 motion or whether or not it was turned into a summary judgment motion. I do agree that the appellant was given an opportunity to present additional evidence. However, in the order that was actually signed by Judge Strong in this matter, it does state there's no question that the adoption in this case was a foster parent adoption and that the relinquishment was not conditioned upon the retention of any parental rights. As such, the court finds that the petitioner has failed to state a claim for which relief can be granted and the petition must be dismissed on respondent's motion, and then goes on to say that the court does not need to consider the evidence submitted by the respondents in order to resolve this case. So I do believe that it was not turned into a summary judgment motion. It was dismissed on a Rule 12b-6 motion.
Should there have been leave granted to amend? It was dismissed with prejudice, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Should there have been leave?
I don't believe that was requested. If it had, I mean, I believe that would have been something that could have happened, yes, but I don't believe that it was requested that he be given leave to amend. The contact agreement was not approved by the court, and that is the basis on the information that I had presented to the court, and I do believe that that is something that is significant in this matter, based on the fact that I will consider her appellant. She alleged that this was based on fraud, duress, coercion. I believe if you look at the contact agreement, which was attached by the appellant to her complaint, it points out the statutory language that states that it cannot be neither the existence of nor the failure of a party to comply with the terms of the communication and contact agreement entered into in the section shall be grounds for setting aside the adoption decree, revoking the written relinquishment of parental rights, or challenging the adoption on the basis of duress or coercion, or challenging the adoption on the basis that the agreement retains some aspects of parental rights by the relinquishing parent or parents. All of those things are exactly what they have claimed in their petition for habeas corpus. And I believe that Nebraska Revised Statute 43-166-6 specifically addresses their entire application or their entire petition.
I want to return and follow up on Judge Stacy's question about amendment even though it was not requested, is it your position that amendment would have been futile? And if it is your position, explain why.
I do believe that the amendment would have been futile. In addressing that, I think that when we look at the four corners of their application, I know that the appellant has today stated that the paragraph 6 specifically stated that there were promises that were made by my clients to the appellant for additional time, all of those things. In the actual application, because they attached the contact agreement, I believe looking at the four corners, it shows what the actual agreement was as to the additional time. I don't believe that there's anything that's put, that there's anything additional besides what was actually entered into with the contact agreement.
What does that mean? There's nothing additional, that it didn't happen, or it has no legal significance?
I am not aware that it actually happened. I can't stand
here today. Is that a question of fact, or is it material?
Yes, I would say it's probably a question of fact. I do not believe that it's material, because I do believe that whatever may have been promised to them was then put into writing and agreed upon by the parties. So I believe that at that point in time, if there was anything that was additional, even if she did take it to the district court because they were not following the contact agreement, if the contact agreement had been approved, they would have still been bound by what the contact agreement said. And so I don't believe that anything additional that would have been agreed upon, if something was there, would have been a material to any type of facts that could have been pled. Based on all of that, I don't know that there's any, based on that and based on the statutory requirements of the contact agreement and how the courts view those contact agreements, I don't know that an amendment would have changed the outcome of this case in the end. I don't believe that there is any way to get around the fact that, A, the appellant relinquished her rights to the Department of Health and Human Services. I believe that that's important based on the fact that this contact agreement is not signed by the Department of Health and Human Services, so I don't believe that it's a promise to whether or not, or a condition upon the relinquishment, as was questioned earlier. I don't believe that contact agreement can be described as that, because, the relinquishment was made directly to the Department of Health and Human Services. They're not a party to that contract. That's something that's outside of that contract, and there is no promise by Health and Human Services when they sign the relinquishment that the parties that are contracted under that contact agreement are going to be the parties that absolutely adopt. The contract agreement was signed in June of 2015. The adoption didn't take place until, I'm sorry, I have the dates written out. I believe it was June of 2015, and the adoption wasn't filed and finalized until May of 2016. That was under no... That was due to the juvenile court proceedings. That was not due to any delay by either party, that it took a year for the adoption to be finalized. However, during that period of time, that almost a year, there's a lot of things that could have happened, and that child could have been moved to a different foster family. The appellant would not have been given notice that the child had been moved because she had already relinquished her rights and given up all notice to those. She would not have been, that contact agreement would not have followed the child to the new parents, the new foster parents, and made them perform under that agreement, because they are not the parties that entered into that contact agreement. So I don't believe that it's a condition, that the contact agreement in and of itself is a condition that would invalidate the relinquishment.
I want to ask you if you think that fraud could ever be used to attack this, a situation where one of these agreements is used, and let's hypothesize, for example, that the foster parents tell the biological parent, well, we're going to sign this agreement, but we're promising you that no matter what it says and no matter what some court does about approving or disapproving it, if we become the adoptive parents, we will make sure that you have contact with the child above and beyond whatever this document says. You think that's conceivable, that that could survive a 12b-6 motion to dismiss?
I believe if it's properly pled, that possibly yes. And I do believe that there has been a case, and I'm trying to find the case site, that specifically found that the contract agreement was not sufficient, and that it was, that the relinquishment was made under fraud and duress based on the fact that she was given, I believe it was presented to her at the time the trial was getting ready to start. She may have been having, she may have just been released from the hospital, had morphine, and so that she was maybe not clear and in her right mind. So I do believe that there are probably circumstances that yes, that it could happen. I don't believe that there's anything in the record that shows my clients were there at the time of the relinquishment. If you look at the contact agreement when it was signed, my client signed it the day before she signed it. There's nothing in the actual agreement that shows that they were actually there making any type of comments to her at the time that the relinquishment actually took place.
And your position is that the allegation of fraud was not made with the particularity required by our rules of pleading?
I would agree with that, yes. I don't believe that there's that he outlined or that the appellant outlined exactly how the fraud took place. I believe that in the, if you look at the actual wording in the petition, it looks as though it was based on the fact that the contract agreement has not been followed through and that she was not given, and that she retained parental rights. However, I also want to point out that I believe that their argument that she was not received notice of whether of the adoption hearing, she was not in a party to any to the adoption hearing, and she was not given notice of the decision of the adoption judge to not approve the contact agreement is dispositive in that she retained parental rights, because if she had parental rights, all of those, she would have had to have notice of all of those things to continue to be able to assert those rights in some fashion. Is there any other questions?
Could an amendment cure this petition?
I don't believe an amendment could cure the petition. We're asking that this court affirm the district court's order and dismiss this for failure to state a claim. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There is no time for rebuttal. So we will go on to the next case of the day, which is